Can a crisis of climate change be solved without the arts and humanities? This podcast is a recording of the international webinar organized by the Australasian Council of Deans of Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities, Dash, the Scottish Arts and Humanities Alliance, SAHA, and the Irish Humanities Alliance, IHA, on the 17th of October 2022, to explore this provocative question and to reflect on how arts and humanities guide reflection, dialogue, and action for climate change mitigation. Perspectives from Scotland, Ireland, Australia, and New Zealand were brought together to reflect on the contribution of these human-centered disciplines to addressing climate change.
Good morning, or good evening, everybody, or some other part of the day if you're joining from some other part of the world. And welcome to the first joint seminar between the Deans of Arts, Social Sciences, Humanities of Australia and New Zealand, the Scottish Arts Humanities Alliance, and the Irish Humanities Alliance. I'm Mara Pittock. I'm co-chair of the Scottish Arts Humanities Alliance, and it's my pleasure today to welcome you to this event, which is to discuss the question of, can a crisis of climate change be solved without the arts and humanities? And that's a really important question for us all, because if we can't convince people that the climate emergency is real, we cannot properly address it. And we convince people ultimately by means of things we study in the arts and humanities, which are narratives, because narratives are a source of power because they set constraints on what is imaginable and what is considered feasible. That's why governments and companies seek to control narratives, and neglecting the study of narratives only for the study of data invites people to construct narratives which oppose or contradict the evidence in front of us. So we need to be able to create narratives to convince. And reflecting on some of the issues around that, we are joined today by a distinguished lineup of speakers. I'm going to introduce them in a moment, and then they will speak continuously. I won't introduce people at each stage, but I'll introduce all our speakers at first glance, as it were. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our distinguished panelists. Those who will speak first are a doubleheader on the Pacific Islands, Migration and Displacement and Indigenous Perspectives, from Professor Robert Greenberg, who's Dean of Arts at the University of Auckland and has a key interest in the language identity in the Balkans. That's been his long-term study and, of course, is extremely important from the point of view of narratives and different kinds of conflicts and emergencies to the one we're discussing today. And Dr. Jamie Gillen, who's Director of the Global Studies Institute at the University of Auckland. They will speak for 5 minutes. They'll be followed by, for the Irish Humanities Alliance, Katrina Nidwi, who is going to speak on language in relation to climate change. Katrina is Professor of German at University College Cork and convener of the Climate and Eco-Humanities Research Group there. They will be followed by Timothy Stott, who will reflect on design, architecture and climate, which is one of his specialisms. He's head of history at Trinity College Dublin, and he's interested very much in visual culture and the climate emergency. Then our two final speakers will be for the Scottish Arts, Arts and Humanities Alliance. They'll be Claire Squires, the director of, that is the dean of the National Graduate School, the Scottish Graduate School of Arts and Humanities, who's been very instrumental in promoting the Earth Studentships in Scotland and also leading the graduate school in participation in COP26 in Glasgow last year. And Professor Catherine O'Leary from University of St Andrews and is co-chair of the Scottish Arts and Humanities Alliance and convenes the Climate Working Group of the Scottish Arts and Humanities Alliance. Okay, we'll look at issues such as EDI, climate justice, and the role of arts and humanities to communicate the issues and imagine solutions. So I'm going to mute and for the next 30 or 40 minutes while our speakers run through in that order. So first of all, Robert and Jamie.
Thank you very much. Kia ora, everyone. Greetings from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I will kick off with a little bit on our indigeneity here, indigenous views, Matauranga Māori, which is Māori knowledge, around the issue of our land and climate change and that perspective. And then Jamie will follow very quickly after with some additional observations. In the Faculty of Arts, as was said, I am Dean, and we are leading the embedding of Indigenous worldviews, Māori and Pacific worldviews, into a lot of the things that we do, both our values as a Faculty of Arts, but also within our education, our modules, our courses, our majors, and as well as our research. And what becomes very apparent is that the Indigenous way, our Māori people of this land, the Indigenous people, the Indigenous way is holistic in its view of issues around earth, weather, climate. And clearly the humanities and arts are part and parcel of how this is viewed holistically. There's no arbitrary distinction between the science side of climate change and, say, the arts and humanities sides. And we can explain these in these Indigenous ways of knowing. That's sort of a key aspect. One of the things that we've just had in New Zealand for the first time is our Matariki holiday, which has become a national holiday. And it really is a forward-looking, inspired by Tanata Whenua, the people of this land, the Indigenous people. It's basically Māori New Year, but it's astronomical in terms of its approach. It looks at the importance of the stars that come out at a certain time of year. But also, and this was so apparent in the celebrations that we had, it's about celebrating Earth and our place in this Earth and being guardians of the Earth and preserving the Earth. And I think that resonates tremendously in this whole conversation around climate change. We also, on the Polynesian side, generally speaking, here in Auckland, this is the largest Polynesian city in the world, in terms of population. Obviously, we also have there for many Pacific Islanders from places like Tuvalu and Samoa and Kiribati in the South Pacific that are really at the crosshairs of this climate crisis, enduring land that is being lost to the Pacific Ocean and feeling that the victims of all the industrial pollution that's being released from the rest of the world. And one of our leading poets within this country, Selina Tusitala Marsh, who hails from the Pacific Islands, she approached the subject of climate change in her poem, Unity, which she performed for the Queen at Westminster Abbey as a Commonwealth gathering of Commonwealth poets. And again, this was a very poignant way of bringing awareness to very key people within the Commonwealth and the monarchy and the highest positions of power, the impacts that the industrialized countries of the world have had on small places, as she called it, one of the smallest of former colonies, Tuvalu, which is a tiny island in the South Pacific. I'm going to stop there and hand it over to Jamie to continue a little bit on the discourse around climate change, the humanities and arts from our perspective in this part of the world. Kia ora, Jamie.
Kia ora, Robert, and kia ora, Tato. Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's nice to be here. I thought I would add a little bit of granularity to Robert's points, more broader points about how we look at climate change from the Aotearoa and the Pacific. I thought I would rattle off a few statistics that we use to share with our students what New Zealanders think about climate change. I'll share that like I do with our students. We also present some of the questions and some of the issues that are pertinent to climate change and the pressures on climate change here in Aotearoa. But much like our students, I'll present some things that we're doing well and things that we've addressed really nicely and we're moving comprehensively towards and positively towards when it comes to climate change. Because at least in where we sit, staying positive and looking at things holistically, as Robert said, and looking at things that could be seen as successes in the climate change challenge are really important to give our students hope. So just some quick quick and dirty statistics about a survey that was done in 2021 to New Zealanders about climate change. 60% of them, of us, are alarmed and concerned. That's fairly good, I think, and probably higher than the rest of the world. 12% of us are cautious. 21% of us are doubtful that climate change is real. And 9% are dismissive of climate change. So on the whole, about 30% of New Zealanders are doubtful or dismissive of climate change. And this is really the target group that we like to talk about in global studies, because these are the folks who haven't been reached. They're typically older, according to the statistical analysis. They don't have as high educational qualifications. They're typically European New Zealander, or what we call Pākehā here. And some of the reasons that they say we don't worry about climate change is that it's not my problem, is one of their biggest reasons. A second reason they don't worry about it is that governments are there to fix it, and that's where our taxes go. Their taxes are there to fix this problem. The third most popular response for why they're dismissive or doubtful is that I don't see it in my everyday life, and the scale and complexity are too much for me to manage. We look at those and we tease those apart, but for the purposes of this webinar and for the last thing I'll say is, what is the success? What are the successes and how have we addressed these dismissive folks and doubtful folks? Well, one is that it's really impossible for people here to argue that we aren't able to connect the dots between the local practices and our global impact on the world. Everything from our carbon footprint to our using disposable or reusable bags at the grocery store, these have become kind of embedded in our conversations here. And that's not accidental. It has to do a lot with the way that Maturanga Māori looks at the world in a very holistic manner, where the environment and its people are not separate but intertwined. And so when we talk to global studies students, we encourage them to stay positive and think about the ways in which Aotearoa has handled things, has achieved statistically some pretty positive numbers when it comes to our approach to climate change due to the influence of Indigenous knowledge. Thanks very much. And kia ora.
Katrina?
Good morning. Hello. Joining from University College Cork in Ireland, and as part of the Irish Humanities Alliance as well. So myself and Timothy Stott will be talking a little bit about what we've done in this space. But I suppose as a linguist, so I'm in a School of Languages, Literatures and Cultures, and I'm in the German department there. I study the reflections on ecological crisis and the Anthropocene in contemporary Austrian culture, particularly. That's a big project I'm just finishing off at the moment. Not that it'll ever be finished. So all sorts of things like how melting glaciers enter into contemporary fiction and anxieties about the rise of eco-fascism. These would be themes that we'll be looking at and how they're reflected through contemporary literature and culture. But because I'm coming from a languages background and looking at how these issues are taken up in different ways in different languages and how we can think about language itself as being not only a system, but as being multiple systems that can model for us some kind of diversity that is also often under threat. I thought I'd begin by doing what I always do with my students, which is going to the wording of the question, which was for this session, how can we solve or can we solve the climate crisis and what role the arts and humanities might play in that task? And I suppose straight away, the skeptical linguist will go to the word solve and think about how that frames our predicament in a certain way as a problem that might admit of a solution that could be found. And in a way, it's that the rhetoric of problem and solution is one that we might take a critical step back from an arts and humanities perspective too. And not in a way to disable that conversation, but maybe to bring a new angle to it, to think in terms of predicaments and greater levels of complexity. I know Tim will be talking later on about the idea of the wicked problem or the super wicked problem. So when we approach a problem as something that can be solved, then we might throw our hands up if we can't immediately find the solution, or we might look for a fix. And I think what arts and humanities disciplines are so good at doing is decelerating the perception. In fact, that's been proposed as one of the functions of art itself, is to decelerate perception, to slow us right down and not to grab a fix in an anxious and reactive way, but rather to try to locate ourselves. So where are we in this crisis? And even speaking the word we, what does it mean? It's been wonderful that this session started off by emphasizing the role of Indigenous knowledges and by locating ourselves globally. So what might it mean to be, might it mean to be located on the periphery of Europe, for example? What is the relationship between the global north and global south and the distribution of global social injustice and uneven impacts of climate change? So all of these questions around complicity, implicatedness, location, how we really find ourselves in this crisis. These are things which are immensely difficult and challenging and can release quite negative affect. I'm very grateful to Jamie for having focused on the positive. I think it's really important to do so. So how can we find hope in our discussions with students around these issues? But likewise, we have a very important role to play in terms of equipping not just our students, but the wider society with richer and more appropriate vocabularies for metabolizing the very difficult emotions that can come up here. And, you know, we're not without resources as far as this is concerned. So if I think in very broad brushstrokes around the history of literature, and I am a literary scholar primarily, one could say that literature arises, the origin of poetry is as a way of trying to deal with loss, as a way of trying to metabolize grief and difficult emotion. So I'm drawing here particularly on the Austrian modernist poet Rainer Maria Rilke, who in his famous Duino elegies proposed precisely this, and he wasn't the first or last person to do so. So that when confronted with something like ecological anxiety or grief around species loss, grief around the loss of habitat and biodiversity, we have cultural resources that can help us to locate ourselves there, that can, drawing on a rich tradition as well from, for example, existentialist philosophy, what happens when we look at climate change as an existential threat? What implications does it have for our own understanding of our existence? So these are some of the questions, I think, and angles that arts and humanities disciplines can bring to the conversation that move us maybe beyond the reach for a fix, that provide us with greater emotional literacy, that enable us to locate ourselves also critically within this wider conversation around global social injustice and uneven impacts. But I wanted to pick up as well on what Jamie said about the 30%, the it's not my problem or somebody else will fix it or it's too big anyway, this kind of resignation that can set in when confronted with problems of this scale. And one perspective I found very useful there is that, for example, of the climate psychology allowance, who differentiate between denial and disavowal. So I think the majority of people now at this stage are beyond the point where they would deny that climate change is happening. So they might acknowledge that it's happening, but they would push it away from themselves and hold it at arm's length, keep it at bay. And this is a phenomenon that's been described as disavowal. So how do we break down the wall of disavowal and enable people, empower people to engage emotionally? And I think that the arts and humanities have a very strong role to play there. They were some of the things I wanted to mention, and I'm happy to hand over now to Timothy Stott.
Thanks, Katrina. I too would want to begin from the question. And of course, my immediate answer to this would be no, because we cannot understand the crisis. We cannot understand the nature of the problems that the crisis gives rise to without the arts and humanities. I'm a historian of art, design and architecture from the 20th century. And I mean, a lot of what I've looked at up until now is how through the 1950s and 1960s, an ecological awareness first comes into the production of art, in particular environmental design and architecture. So no, we cannot understand the problem or the problems, the nature of the problems without the arts and humanities, because they are complex, wicked and super wicked. I'll come to this in a moment. I mean, certainly the history of art and design offers a whole array of solutions. If the climate crisis is a crisis in how we build, then certainly within the history of building, there are alternatives, whether they are passive heating and ventilation systems, alternative building materials, thinking of urban agriculture, cities as a kind of living machine. And this becomes especially important when we're looking for solutions, but also when we're trying to understand how, as we hope will increasingly become the case amongst architects, we try to retrofit rather than new build, because that implies an understanding of the history of the city. But as Katrina pointed out, I'd also want to just mention the idea of a wicked problem. I mean, this idea has become very prominent, especially in policy around environment and environmental governance, even under now understanding the climate crisis as a super wicked problem, as though a wicked problem was not wicked enough. So we might look back at the history of design and architecture and look where the idea of a wicked problem emerges. Actually, a designer called Horst Rittel introduced it in the mid-1960s to show, and I think this the example of Rittel is really important to us. He introduced it to show how social problems differ from techno-scientific ones, and that design problems are first and foremost social problems rather than techno-scientific ones. When they're presented as techno-scientific ones, they're often presented as complicated, but essentially benign rather than wicked. Instead of systems building and instead of this kind of whole kind of machine of design solutions that's been gathered up under the name of sustainability, the likes of Rittel would kind of put a brake on that and urge architects and designers to be pragmatic and to realize that a design problem, whatever it might be, cannot be formulated completely. So they're always working to a greater or lesser degree blind, which means that the solutions that they offer, however elegant they might be, can often make the problem worse. So a design problem can never be solved. And I think this points to our politics, it points to consultancy and how we engage with communities that are impacted by design solutions as they are implemented. Whether that's wind farms, whether that's greening the city, whatever it might be. And Rittel and others working in Berkeley at the time also advanced an idea that design had to be holistic. It was one of those few disciplines that could afford to be holistic. And I think that this is something that we should really try to hold on to. So the idea of a wicked problem has a history itself, and we should understand this history as we try to understand the wicked problem of climate change. I, like Jamie, would try to be optimistic. I think this is especially important for us as teachers, to offer optimism, to offer hope to our students, because you can see that the problem often overwhelms them. It weighs them down and they don't see how they can possibly offer solutions. I remember Anand Singh saying way back in 2015, with a great deal of optimism, for the first time in my lifetime, natural scientists are looking for help from humanists in knowing the world. So I guess that's a cause for hope. But then the question is, how do we engage with those scientists? How do we even just bring humanists together? And this is certainly something that we've tried to do, as have many other organizations, some of whom, of course, are represented today, to bring humanists together around this problem so that, first of all, we know what we can offer. And then we can go and talk and converse and debate with our scientist colleagues and peers.
Hi, I'll jump in next. I'm the director of the Scottish Graduate School for Arts and Humanities, which, for those of you who aren't aware, is Scotland's national graduate school for arts and humanities. We offer PhD funding and training and development opportunities across Scotland, but also increasingly have an international brief as well. And I'll come back to talking about that at the end. The environmental humanities are one of our strategic themes and priority areas. And that was important for me when I took over the directorship of SAGSA 2.5 years ago, but also kind of very much arose from the desires and intellectual orientations of the people putting in for PhD funding. Quite a number of people obviously really being engaged with issues around climate emergency. This led us last year to the development of a green graduate strategy and operations plan, which you can see on our website, sagsa.ac.uk, if you're interested, which was created with the belief that as the world's first national graduate school for the arts and humanities, we're uniquely placed to leverage the intellectual and creative power of our doctoral community and beyond to tackle the climate emergency. So obviously answering the question of this is this webinar right there. And our belief is that we recognise the existential nature of the climate crisis and the need for profound changes in everyone's behaviour. And the aim of the plan, it's a strategy and an operations plan. So on those two levels. So first of all, we have been doing lots of work to interrogate our own operational processes and develop environmentally sustainable policy and processes. And doctoral community has constantly been keeping us right, occasionally accusing us of greenwashing, making sure that we're really pushing ourselves as far as we can. But then also to advance thinking around the role of arts and humanities research, and particularly at PhD and early career researcher level, including within the environmental arts and humanities and interdisciplinary terms. We very much want to leverage our status as a national graduate school to take a leading position in addressing the challenges of climate change. And I suppose as well, and I think this is interesting, important actually, thinking about the attacks in some parts of the world on the arts and the humanities, really aligning us with external drivers, forcing us to work from funders, forcing us to work in an interdisciplinary way, demonstrating our worth in addressing these problems. As Murray referred to in his introduction, we set up a series of events, including at COP26 in Glasgow last year, and we've tried particularly hard to do this in interdisciplinary partnerships, so hackathons, for example. At the moment, we're working on generating environmental impact statements for arts and humanities research for our funded researchers, and I'd be really interested to hear if anyone else has got particular experience of doing that as we work on it. And then finally, and as Murray again referred to in the introduction, to tell you a little bit about a current funding scheme that we have available, an international funding scheme, the Earth Scholarships, which is funded by British Council Scotland, really as a legacy of their COP26 programming and thinking about the bringing together of arts, culture and education. The scheme is currently live right now. Its intent is to bring international PhD and ECRs, a very tight definition of ECRs, just 1 year post-PhD, to Scotland in 2023 for up to 3 months. Applications are open now with a deadline quite soon. So if you or anyone in your networks is interested, please take a look at our website right now. The deadline is 7th of November. As part of that as well, we're going to have a really exciting cohort training event for two weeks in April 23 for Scotland-based PhD researchers. So if anyone's listening on the webinar who is a PhD researcher in arts and humanities or a supervisor of one in Scotland, please again take a look at our website and put an application in to join that programme in April. So that's just a kind of, rapid overview of the work that we're doing at SAGSA, and happy to talk about any of those aspects a little bit more. But right now I'll hand over to Catherine.
Thanks, Claire. Thank you, everybody. I'm also here from the Scottish Arts and Humanities Alliance, as Murray said, and I'm going to just say a little bit about what is going on within the Alliance and within the university sector in Scotland. And just to reiterate, I guess, the idea that the focus on humans and how we interact with our environment and how we live in it and how we shape our world and engage with our world is what we bring to the conversations. But part of what we need to do is to make sure we are in the conversations that are taking place with policymakers and decision makers. And picking up on things that Jamie said and Murray said, I guess, our argument is that a cultural focus can help us not only to explain problems, but can also persuade the doubters with the use of narratives and popular culture. We need to think about how the past can help us to inform our understanding. And again, that links in with what Robert was saying about the knowledge from Indigenous communities that we need to harness and respect in our decision making. And the question of values in decision making is one that is very much at the heart of lots of arts and humanities work. The language we use to discuss the issues, who we are choosing to discuss these issues with. But also we need to think about what are the human roots of the issues that we are discussing. So I think we are clear that science and technology are necessary, but a humanities focus is also necessary in conjunction with that. In terms of the university sector in Scotland, it's quite an interesting moment just now. Claire told us about what's going on in the Scottish Graduate School. The UK Research and Innovation Council, the National Research Council, is clear that arts and humanities are vital to tackling climate change, and they are stating that clearly. And this kind of high-level focus will help to engage a broader public, but also to shape collaborative, human-focused solutions coming out of interdisciplinary university work. In Scotland, the Scottish Funding Council has created alliances for research challenges with the aim of connecting Scotland's university research with national challenges and government priorities. And they've identified areas such as energy transition and sustainability, food systems, and the natural economy and the blue economy. So again, we're looking at how we can collaborate with colleagues in science and social science to bring the arts and humanities voice into these conversations and research. In Scottish universities, there's lots of interesting things happening. In some universities, such as my own, there are common cross-disciplinary modules encouraging students to think about sustainability upon entry in the university, where they do a compulsory module in first year. There are lots of centres and networks, the Edinburgh Environmental Humanities Network, Stirling Centre for Environment, Heritage and Policy, Strathclyde Centre for Environmental Law and Governance, and so on. So there's a lot happening. There's loads of interesting programmes emerging from arts and humanities disciplines as well, about literature, landscape and built environment in Aberdeen. And in Glasgow, there's a master's programme on environment, culture and communication. So there's new and interesting ways to think about how arts and humanities are influencing the debates and the conversations. So our challenge is, how do we join all of this up? So Murray already mentioned that SAHA has a working group that is focusing on this, and we bring together the graduate school, higher education institutions across Scotland and the Royal Society of Edinburgh to have these conversations and to identify what we are all doing and what our common interest and purpose is. So we've drafted a document that we are now looking at and agreeing as a statement of where we are at and what we would like to do. And our goal is to help colleagues to create useful narratives and to show how arts and humanities skills help us to communicate the crisis, to imagine solutions, to inform discussions, but also to amplify local voices and to preserve local knowledge. As an academic, we need to think about, how can we help our colleagues to bring ideas together, to connect with each other across disciplines, but also within our institutions? And events like this one are really important for thinking about how we can engage internationally. How can we learn from each other? And what do we do after we have come together? And finally, what's our duty as educational institutions? There's a question both of what can we learn from our students and from our community partners, but also how do we influence the influencers? Our students go on to be leaders in communities, in business, in education. How are we equipping them to influence others and to offer, amongst other things, hope, as was mentioned earlier? That's me.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Thanks to all our speakers. Can I now ask for questions from the participants in this seminar? I haven't got anything in the Q&A, so I might just set the ball rolling by asking Timothy. Talking about wicked problems is really meat and drink to my ears and stomach. It's very good to hear you described in this way and for you to examine some of the issues that underpin that. I wanted to get your opinion. We hosted at the Royal Society of Edinburgh a visit from the Dutch Society of Arts and Humanities at the end of last week. And I was wondering about what your opinion was on, for example, the long-standing now and intensifying Dutch planning policy towards greening environments and city spaces, and particularly its collocation with smart city development in Amsterdam in the last 5 or 6 years. Do you think that that's effective, or do you think that it's window dressing, or does it lie somewhere between the two?
Thank you, Murray. I wouldn't know too much about the Dutch example. I mean, from what I do know, I think, again, as ever, there's an elegance to Dutch planning solutions just because of the premium upon space. One example that I often use from Holland, which was largely seen as a failure, was the Oosterwaardeplassen, which was an attempt to rewild a section of reclaimed land at the very edge of Amsterdam. And that example was instructive, or I tried to make it instructive to my students, because again, of coming back to that earlier point about what we value and how we can imagine things like biodiversity. I mean, this was an example where we had a massive, or where there was a massive die-off of higher mammals, which was seen as catastrophic, which was one of the reasons the experiment was stopped. But that also led to a large increase in beetles, different forms of insects, etc. Which, so in one sense, it was highly biodiverse. In another sense, it was catastrophic. So I think, you know, the way in which we frame our view of what biodiversity looks like is really, really important. When it comes to the city, I think we have a lot to learn. I mean, I think the idea, as I said very briefly earlier, the idea of urban agriculture, which is something that is really ingrained in Dutch planning, is something that we really need to consider. We need to use our old buildings in Dublin here. We have an ongoing housing crisis, which has many strands to it. But a lot of that is our insistence on new builds and our inability to do anything with a lot of our old building stock. I mean, I was speaking with an architect friend of mine a few weeks ago, and he said, you know, the first thing that architects should do in order to address the climate crisis is to stop building.
Very interesting point. Claire?
Yeah, thanks. I had a question for everyone, but also wanted to make a kind of short comment about it before I started. And I suppose this is thinking about how the arts and humanities might help us think through what might be perceived as, and I'm doing scare quotes here if you're just listening, not watching, wicked solutions or wicked responses as well as wicked problems. So I suppose I'm thinking through how we respond to or be part of climate activism. I'm particularly reminded of this by two things. First of all, that within some of the consultation events that we did in developing our green graduate policy, one of our funded PhD researchers said, what is SAGSA, what's your organization's response to funding someone who might have a criminal record for climate activism? And I thought, well, in one sense, we don't assess people's criminal records anyway. It's not something that we get hold of. So in one way, in a very pragmatic way, it's a non-question. But obviously, from an arts and humanities response and thinking about what happened at the National Gallery over the weekend, where two climate activists threw some cans of tomato soup, something which in, you know, artistic form has also been in a gallery before. What? How do we think about that? How do we think about those different forms of value when we're assessing what kind of might be the most appropriate responses from, you know, maybe the kind of deep thinking that we might engage with as arts and humanities academics, that some of the teaching activities that colleagues have referred to kind of earlier on, and thinking about, you know, those different forms of value. You know, one of the most expensive paintings in the world, albeit behind glass and actually terribly safe, versus, you know, what's happening in terms of the relationship between humans, animals, nature in the Pacific Islands, where, you know, at the most cutting edge of climate change, something is happening. You know, how are we valuing those different things, the high kind of establishment versions of human culture that you might have. So I'd be really interested to ask colleagues about that, you know, how we think about the history of political activism in terms of the suffragettes, for example, and how we think about climate activism now. Thanks.
So before asking anyone to ask that, and I hope to get up your answers, we do have a question from participants with the speakers. So I will ask that, which is that Dee asks, UKRI does seem to be driving more interdisciplinary funding schemes, which often demand arts, humanities, and or social science. What are the panel's view on these interdisciplinary schemes? And what is the experience of interdisciplinarity? Are the arts, humanities leading the interdisciplinary agenda enough? So I might put that one back to you, Claire, I have to say.
Yeah, I think it's a really important question. I think there can often be the challenge that we are seen as the frothy, creative stuff that's put on the top of science understandings. And I think it's really important that we think about what we mean when we say, you know, our skills in terms of narrative and communication, because yes, those are absolutely integrally some of the aspects of environmental arts and humanities. But I think it's really important that particularly forms of creativity aren't then become instrumentalist. You know, they're about different ways of thinking and understanding in and of themselves. So I think that form of leading and making sure that ideas about the human and the post-human are really integrated into thinking rather than something that, you know, we know many people are denying it and many people are disavowing it. And Katrina, in the terminology that you use, but really kind of thinking through, it's not just about communicating. It's about more than that. It's about different forms of worldview as well. Thanks.
Katrina, did you have your hand up?
I had my hand up in response to something Tim had said, but it maybe connects to this as well. And I suppose it's about the question of how we build those interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary conversations and relationships. And it can be this switching between different scales. That's a topic that often comes up, for example, in eco-criticism and environmental humanities research. I'm thinking particularly of the work of Tim Clark, or someone like Timothy Morton, where it's the problem is that you have disjunction of the very local. What am I doing in my job? How am I talking to my students? How am I designing my module? And then you're constantly switching up and back between this, the planetary frame of the melting glaciers and ice caps and the global impacts and all of the anxiety that goes along with that. So how do you navigate that? And I thought that what you said, Tim, about what they need to do is stop building, you know, that this, again, coming back to this notion of deceleration and really unpacking and dismantling the whole mind frame and mindset that has led us into the illusion of infinite growth on a planet of finite resources. You know, so maybe starting with that notion that what we need to do is sort of retrofit our minds as well as our buildings. And we do, one of the ways we can do this is by drawing on the resources of our intellectual traditions and cultural traditions and archives that we have. So that's in a sort of general way that the principle of retrofitting that you were talking about there, or of a deceleration, of not always going to innovation. And I'm really struck by the fact that innovation and activity seem to be the paradigms in which we operate. You know, you have to always set out with your new research project what's going to be new about it, what paradigm shift you're going to achieve, why this hasn't been done before, and so therefore it needs to be funded. But that's actually not a paradigm that's always the most appropriate one for arts and humanities research. Sometimes it is about speaking back to and from a tradition, finding its resources that may have been overlooked, activating what Ernst Bloch, the German philosopher, calls this sort of utopian kernel within something that may be much older, that may have been overlooked before. So I think that sort of intellectual retrofitting is something that I like to think with. But about the transdisciplinary and interdisciplinary conversations with the natural sciences, again, this shifting between scales is hugely important. So the first thing you do is you go and have a cup of coffee with someone from the other side of the campus. And I have found that to be a really helpful way forward. And you really just sit down and talk to each other about each other's research and you build it from there. And that might seem terribly small and ineffectual, but we're always shifting between the scales. And that's where those breakthroughs can happen. So, you know, in terms of what we do after this conversation, what I would love to think is that we as arts and humanities scholars, you know, we'll pick up the phone, we'll send that email, say, meet me next week to someone from biological and earth sciences. That can be a really helpful way forward.
Okay, Robert.
Thank you. No, and just on that same very issue of the collaboration, I think it's our role as leaders in the arts and humanities to really front foot the conversation with our colleagues across the university. And I agree that there's that danger of us becoming the afterthought. Often I see that we need a social scientist or a humanities scholar to help us out because, you know, we want to get the funding or we want to look innovative. Actually, we should be at the beginning of the conversation, the middle of the conversation, and close the deal with our colleagues. We have an experiment going here at our university. It's a transdisciplinary research center, approximately 100 researchers. We'll see how this goes, but it's co-hosted by four of our faculties, science, arts, engineering, and business and economics. And it's called the Center for Climate, Biodiversity, and Society. We have high hopes that it will be a good example of that kind of really equal partnership and collaboration among us all. We are contributing both somebody to be in the communication space here, to be one of their main communicators for the project, but we also are contributing a doctoral, one of our doctoral scholarships for the project. Jamie's involved in it as well through his own research, and a few of our researchers are involved. And what's interesting in our context now is that indigeneity is, we're trying to again front and center that. It has a Maori name, Nara Fetu, with the indigenous knowledges being part of that whole way of looking at the issue. So it's a great development. It's early days. We'll have to come back in 1 or 2 or 3 years and I can update you on how well it's gone. But we have high hopes that maybe that example and something we'd be happy to share with others who might want to do something similar, how we went about it and how it's shaping up. So I thought I'd just contribute that.
Great. Thanks, Robert. So, okay. So, this is relevant to what you just said, but Farman Ali has just asked how the marginalized population can be included at the policy level of climate change, pointing out in particular that climate change is affecting disabled people, especially those living in the global south. And an instance of that is the recent flood in Pakistan, which has affected disabled people, and many people were impaired also subsequently as a result of that flood. So that's the first question, the inclusion of the marginalized population. And the second is there any scholarships available for students who would like to address the issue of climate change and the way it affects disabled people directly or indirectly in the developing world? So it's a question about the inclusion of marginal communities, including the disabled, and scholarships for any study of that particular issue in the developing world. Anyone on the panel want to tackle those questions?
I think I would just say that, without having a direct answer to the question, that equalities issues are at the heart of the arts and humanities engagement with climate. There is a values issue, there's an equalities issue, because the people who are most affected are not the power holders here. So it is necessary that we, as people who are engaged in questions of ethics and questions of value, that we prod and ask the questions about who is this for? Who are the solutions for when policymakers are discussing solutions, or when our colleagues in science and technology are coming up with solutions? We need to be inserting the human question in there and asking who this is for. So it's not a direct answer to that, but I do think that we need to be conscious of the people and the communities who are at the heart of why we are engaging with this and of the problem.
Yep, and I could add there that we feel this acutely from our neighborhood here in the South Pacific. So I was at a documentary film festival several years ago here in Auckland, and there was a documentary from the Gilbert Islands, or Kiribati, which is really at the coldface of climate change, of the oceans just inundating, the ocean is inundating the island and they're losing land. So it's very tangible. It was a wonderful event to have this film shown here, but I'm sure that the awareness could really be spread much farther afield than, say, a bespoke sort of festival as that one was. But again, I think those voices are, we hear them in our part of the world, but I'm concerned that we need to give them that agency and that ability to be heard well across the globe, because this is where we're the immediate crisis, homes being lost, territories being lost, is so acute. And similarly, I guess, with the disability communities and say what you just described in the question in Pakistan. So I think we've got a huge contribution to play. It could be, you know, we in programmatic as institutions, we can think about this in our communication programs. We've got one called Communication and Social Change, but I could easily see environmental humanities programs, disability studies, lots of these areas. I think units on climate change, with our ability to communicate those things as humanities and arts and humanities people, I think that's a way forward. So it's a really good question, and it's a challenging one to give a positive way forward, but I think we can all just continue and work hard in that space.
So Claire, could you come in?
Just remind you that Earth scholarships that I mentioned earlier on are for PhD researchers from all around the world, and they have a particular focus actually on the global south. So if that's the area of study that you're in, please do take a look at those. We are more general PhD schemes, so 3.5 years worth of funding are open to people from all around the world. So if you do think that's something that's of interest to you, our competitions for this year are just open, so take a look. I'm also happy to speak to people individually about funding opportunities, and so perhaps someone can drop my email in the chat, which is director@sagsa.ac.uk, and happy to talk more off this call. Thank you.
Thanks, colleagues. We are coming to the close of this event, which has been extraordinarily experimental as it is, has been extraordinarily dynamic in the number of issues raised. There are two questions which are related from Mary Branigan and from Jane Palmer in the Q&A. Mary asks about the indigenization of the curriculum and the integration of the holistic understanding of the Maori worldview, the absence of separation into disciplinarity and Western taxonomies, and how people are approaching this in the UK, well, perhaps in this case in the UK and Ireland. So if there are any responses from Saha or the IHA. And Jane asks about Indigenous futurisms, a statement that Indigenous peoples remain undefeated. They offer an aesthetic spring from the trap of the present, as artists are haunted by a disappeared past can reclaim possible futures of aesthetic creation, and that's specifically angled towards Robert and or Jamie. So the first question about transcultural indigenous issues, I think, to be honest, I'm going to suggest, Catherine, do you want to answer that? I'm very happy to say something, but if you want to answer it, that's fine.
You go ahead, Murray.
Okay. I think the issue is, in a sense, are fundamentally different, not from the issues, say, in Canada or New Zealand or Australia, in the sense that although there are wide and very diverse multicultural communities, many of whom share and the fundamental taxonomies of the Western approach, some of whom don't, there isn't, as it were, a strong indigenous community with inherited and overlooked rights which we have to accommodate. So that's what I would say from the point of view, Saha. But we nonetheless are, there is a general move, certainly among opinion formers in the arts and humanities, because it's to our advantage to move away from a segmented to a more holistic approach. And indeed, the leadership phenomenon here is absolutely critical. I remember going to an event about the University of Manchester's strategic alliance with NESTA, the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Art. And really, the point the people were really engaging with was how far the arts and humanities could be used as a vehicle, and I put it bluntly, to take engineers and life scientists to the opera in an educated way. We need to get absolutely away from that. And that, so the holistic approach, because people are part of every research question, is the approach we all need to pursue. And it's one which actually fits with the agenda that you're describing, where there's a particular strong indigenous community who's never inherited those Western post-enlightenment taxonomies.
Yeah, and I would just add, I mean, on the indigenous futures here, it's something we think about literally every day. It's something that we're in the process of in many of our universities here, and socially and politically as well in Aotearoa New Zealand. And I think there's impact also in across the Tasman Sea in Australia now too, where this is, especially with the new government that has taken the power recently, to really look at the future, and indigenous futures are quite salient now in a lot of our conversations, from revitalizing indigenous languages to incorporating indigenous worldviews into our taxonomies, our ways of thinking, decolonizing and indigenizing as much as we can, say, our curricula, our ways of thinking, not negating the Western ones, but looking at the complementary nature of having both, of learning both ways of thinking.
Thanks very much. And thanks very much also to our participants in all today, Robert, Jamie, Katrina, Timothy, Claire, and Catherine. Thank you so much also for those who joined us this morning, evening, or afternoon, wherever you are. This event is going to be converted into a podcast and going to be shared across the three organizing institutions, the Deans of Arts, Social Science, Humanities in Australia and New Zealand, the Scottish Arts Humanities Alliance, the Irish Humanities Alliance. And I do hope, introductory as this conversation has been, one of the strengths in reclaiming a holistic partnership purpose for the arts and humanities can be international cooperation on this and other major global issues, where we need to share a sense of common purpose, because having a single voice for the arts and humanities is one of the most critical things we can do to get ourselves taken seriously. And I think we've shown how many areas that single voice can engage within the climate emergency this morning, afternoon, and evening. So thank you, everybody, very much. And enjoy the rest of your day, however long that may be.
Thank you, Murray. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you, Murray.